And we're just about to enter another wing of this prison, but this time going underground. And it could potentially be getting more serious as we go down underground. In a place that's totally shut off from any kind of light, these are further cells that were uncovered. The thick black cobwebs on the roof, still present, accentuate the sense of dread.
And the word Allah is something that we found to be inscripted on many occasions on these walls. Amanatullah, Ya Rab, Ya Allah. These type of words were again and again found on different portions of this this particular underground compartment, which had to be some sort of a solitary confinement.
Radio Islam's on-the-ground reporting from the Saydunaya prison on the 11th of February 2025 evoked reactions of horror, shock and astoundment. Our footage captured the prison as a fresh crime scene, broken walls and holes dug everywhere to free detainees, posters of prisoners that were still not found, communal cells that showed evidence of extreme crowding, underground wings that revealed the darkest of horrors, and yet other sections where human beings are alleged to have been slaughtered and dismembered in the most ghastly of ways.
We saw pictures of corpses. We saw there's a room in Harasta Military Hospital piled full of corpses that had been brought from Saydunaya. In Saydunaya, they found a mass grave with bodies partially dissolved in acid. They found a press for pressing corpses to turn them into a thin sheet, with a room full of nooses for hanging people. I saw a video yesterday of a man who had been in Saydunaya for 7 years. He said every day, every single day, people were taken and executed. And he was then reciting the names. He'd remembered the names of the person, their father's name, their mother's name, their place of birth. And he was reciting them so that people can find out. And this has kind of destroyed the euphoria of victory to some extent. We knew it was bad, but when you actually see it, when you see people who have survived but have lost their minds, people who are no longer able to speak, people who no longer know what their name is, people who are just shivering and flinching. There are people in there who believe that Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar al-Assad, they believe that he was still in power. People who've been in there for 40, 50 years or longer and have no idea, they've not seen the sun. Children that have either been young children that have been arrested and taken and tortured in these dungeons, in these hell on earth environments, and children that have been born in there to mothers who have been raped, children who have never been outside. I mean, this is horror on an enormous scale. This is one of the worst torture states in history.
As eye-opening a visit to Saydunaya is, one is still required to do much mental processing thereafter to truly understand the sights encountered, as well as to place it within the wider context of the autocratic rule of Bashar al-Assad.
It was a torture state. It was a surveillance, detention and torture state. Prisons were absolutely central to Assad regime rule. There's an estimate that at least 130,000, as a bare minimum, 130,000 people are in Assad prisons. And Fadl Abdel Ghani of the Syrian Network for Human Rights broke down during an interview on television into tears and said, "I'm sorry, but I have to tell the families that we now think that the vast majority of those people are dead."
Aiding our understanding of incarceration and torture as a tool of control for the regime are the accounts of former prisoners. We meet up with a detainee of Saydunaya who is now a high-ranking official in the new government. We also have the account of Basil Nasser Shuha of the Social Development Ministry, who, though was not imprisoned in Saydunaya, shares echoes of the same experience through his incarceration in the notorious so-called Palestine Branch prison. This prison gained widespread notoriety in the wake of the September the 11th events, due to Muslims accused of supposed terrorism being sent there through extraordinary renditions, primarily by the United States, as a means of outsourcing torture.
Let me just quote a former CIA operative who talks about the relationship between the CIA and the various Arab regimes with which they worked. And so he says, Robert Baer, that if we wanted, me, the CIA, wanted an interrogation, a robust interrogation, we send them to Jordan. And if we want them tortured, we send them to Syria. And if we want them disappeared completely, you will never see them again, we send them to Egypt. So we know that individuals were sent to Egypt, to Libya, to Morocco, and other places, because they would do in their countries things that even the Americans wouldn't do. So we call this the outsourcing of the torture program. But one place that people were sent to for the torture, and the most frightening of those places, was Syria. And I know this personally because in Bagram, the United States CIA agents used to threaten me, Muazzam or 558, which is my number, if you don't cooperate, we will send you to either Syria or Egypt.
The cells are described as being the size of a coffin, 2 by 1.5 meters. The cells were infested with cockroaches, fleas, rats, mice, and lice. Prisoners are given one bottle for urine and another for drinking water. Access to the prison yard for natural sunlight is limited to 10 minutes per month. Nasser speaks about prisoners only being allowed 10 seconds in the toilet to relieve themselves. If they were not complete in this period, the doors of the toilet would be kicked open and they would be humiliated. He recounts being taken for torture to a certain room number 4, notorious for the punishment that would occur there. Nasser was tied to the roof by his hands and remained suspended in this position for hours. Other accounts of former detainees chronicle how they were beaten with hard plastic tubes for hours. Interrogators stuck pencils into the bodies of detainees and then purposefully broke the pencils so that a piece of the pencil remained stuck in the prisoner's flesh. Another prisoner was beaten with a meat hook on a chain. In one instance, interrogators poured cleaning chemicals on a prisoner's body, which caused severe burns. They then prevented him from washing it off. Other torture tools included cables, sticks, pipes, as well as electric shocks. In prison, we were only referred to with numbers, says Nasser. Our names did not exist. He exited the prison with skin diseases due to the extremely dirty condition of the cells. Back to Saidunnaya, we dig deeper to put a story to the shocking images we have seen. There are two detention centers at the Saidunnaya military prison, which could hold between 10,000 and 20,000 people. In the Red Building, the majority of detainees were civilians who had been arrested since the beginning of the revolution in 2011. In the White Building, the majority of detainees were officers and soldiers in the Syrian military who had been arrested since 2011. Throughout their detention, the vast majority of detainees were subjected to enforced disappearance, cut off from their family, friends, and the outside world. Their families were never told where they are held or whether they are still alive. Detainees were tortured beginning from the moment of their arrest. New inmates were subjected to what was known as the welcome party, during which they were systematically beaten. One former detainee, Salam, a lawyer from Aleppo, described how the soldiers would practice their hospitality with each new group of detainees during the welcome party. You are thrown to the ground and they use different instruments for beating, electric cables with exposed copper wire ends. They have little hooks so that they take a part of your skin, normal electric cables, plastic water pipes of different sizes, and metal bars. All you see is blood, your own blood, the blood of others. After one hit, you lose your sense of what is happening, but then the pain comes. In Saidunnaya, prisoners' capacity to see anything was highly restricted. From the time detainees were taken from their homes or pulled out of protests and thrown into cells, they were blindfolded. In the cells, they were kept in darkness, made to cover their eyes and face the wall in the presence of guards. Over time, they developed an acute sensitivity to sound. As well as darkness, silence was brutally enforced. To speak, cough, or audibly move was to risk death. Even when the prisoners were being beaten, they could not make a sound, and thousands of those who could not stop themselves from crying out were killed. Former prisoners speak of everything in Tsedenaya being geared towards a deliberate campaign of extermination. Besides mass hangings, there were also disgusting accounts of forced rape and starvation. Detainees described their rapid loss of weight in prison. Our t-shirts became so big that we looked like children wearing our father's clothes. Our shapes were changing in front of our eyes. The bones started to come out. You could see our collarbones, our shoulder bones. We were turning into new people, starving people. The most common punishment to prisoners was to cut off the water. Days would go by with no water to drink, no water to clean, no water to flush the toilet. Sometimes prisoners would be fed a big quantity of food, but the Assad regime guards cut off the water so that prisoners couldn't use the bathroom. They explain that the jailers were forcing them to eat and to create waste they couldn't get rid of, which would create a horrible smell. We used to sometimes throw the food from the vent so that we wouldn't be forced to live with our waste, they said. Almost all of the prisoners would have scabies, lice, and diarrhea. A former prisoner says, "We were covered in red sores. They would be full of pus, and when the pus exploded out, it would leave a hole behind that you can't get rid of. It took me 2 years after I was released to get rid of these holes." Most ominous at Tsedenaya were the mass killings of detainees. Since 2011, executions at Tsedenaya have been carried out in secret and are humanly known only to the guards and officials who are directly involved, as well as high-level Syrian regime officials. Most of those hanged and secretly buried had been subjected to enforced disappearance in Tsedenaya. Their families still have no information about their fate. Before they were hanged, the victims were condemned to death in a trial lasting 1 to 3 minutes at a military field court. On the day the prison authorities carried out the hangings, which they referred to as the party, they collected those who would be executed from their cells in the afternoon. The authorities informed the detainees that those who are selected will be transferred to one of the civilian prisons inside Syria, which was a deception. The listed detainees were put into the train position. In this position, the detainees form a line and each takes hold of the t-shirt or waist of the detainee in front of him and ducks his head down to waist level. The detainees were then taken to the collection room underground, where they were subjected to severe beating, which usually took place between 10 p.m. and 12 a.m. Between 12 a.m. and 3 a.m., the detainees were then handcuffed, blindfolded with their hands behind their backs, and led into vehicles just outside of the Red Building. 5 or 6 guards from the Red Building oversaw this process. Fellow prisoners recount hearing screaming and yelling at this time. "People were screaming like they had lost their minds," said another prisoner. "It wasn't a normal sound. It was not ordinary. It sounded like they were skinning them alive." Transported in fridge trucks from the Red Building to the White Building, when a detainee is brought into the execution room, at this point, he is still unaware of what is to happen. However, on entering the room, detainees were ordered to form a queue up to a small desk in the corner of the room. Here, an instruction is given that each detainee must express his last wishes and place a fingerprint on a statement documenting his death. That instruction is the first moment that the detainees know they will be put to death. Even so, they are still unaware of how this will be carried out. For this entire period, they remain blindfolded. According to a former prisoner official, some of them were silent after they put their fingerprints on the paper, and some of them just fainted right there. But they didn't know when it would happen, or how it was going to happen. By hanging, shooting, or some other way. After this, the detainees were led onto the platforms, still blindfolded. They would be lined up and readied for execution. Then they would put the nooses on and push them or drop them immediately, so they didn't know what was happening until the very last moment. A former military officer described how after the bodies were taken away, they could see the slippers of the deceased outside the window of the cell. If there were 30 slippers, then we knew that 15 people were executed. There were usually between 30 and 80 slippers outside. Bodies of the deceased were then loaded into a truck, transferred to the Tishrin Hospital for registration, and finally brought to mass graves located on military land near Damascus. We also learn of the two so-called salt rooms at Sidonia. These rooms had a layer of salt, usually for de-icing roads, but they were also used as mortuaries to preserve dead bodies in the absence of refrigerated morgues. When a detainee at Sidonia died, their bodies would be left inside a cell with other inmates, sometimes for 2 to 5 days, before being taken to the disturbing salt room. Sidonia is more than just a prison. It is a wound that refuses to heal, a scar etched into the collective memory of the oppressed. It stands as a stark embodiment of dhulm, the very definition of darkness in Islam. Beyond the broken walls and silent corridors, the suffering of Sidonia persists in the unanswered questions of families who will never find their loved ones. Thousands remain unaccounted for, lost to the abyss of enforced disappearance, their voices stifled, their stories untold. The trauma-inflicted year does not end at its gates. It lives on in survivors, in grieving families, and in the memory of a nation struggling to emerge under the weight of its past. Sidonia typifies darkness on every level. Its walls have witnessed unspeakable horrors. Its corridors have swallowed the cries of the tortured, and its grounds have become unmarked graves for the forgotten. But no tyranny lasts forever. In Islam, dhulm is doomed to perish. For darkness, no matter how deep, is always at war with light. And even in the bleakest of places, the pursuit of justice, truth, and remembrance remains a flame that cannot be extinguished.